CSI with world-famous psychic and medium Sherry Mancuso and her co-host, John Scarano.
Hello, and welcome to Psychic CSI on planetparanormal.com. I'm John Scarano.
And I'm Sherry Mancuso.
We're very excited to be back here with you tonight. We've got a great show lined up for you. So hang on to your seats. Sherry's going to be talking about two very famous cases from her past, cases that were extremely influential on her developing her ability to become a psychic CSI. We've had tons of emails. Thank you so much.
Keep writing.
Yes.
Love that.
Keep them cards and letters coming, folks. Sherry's going to answer some of those emails tonight. We had one very special email. Very special email.
Very emotional. You'll definitely want to hear this one.
Sherry really wants to share that email with you. There's a great message in there. So that we'll be doing last thing on the show. With that said, Sherry, it's a great time to start with some emails right now.
Okay, and we're going to start with an email that I thought was very good. It says, "Hi, Sherry. Thank you for taking my question. Can I communicate with my nephew who passed away 5 months ago on the Ouija board?" The answer is no. Mm-hmm. "I have a good intuition and can use the Ouija board alone." Forget it. Don't use it. "But I don't know if I should trust it." No, you shouldn't trust it. "He was only 20, and it's been devastating to our entire family." I know that it's sad when you lose someone, because I deal with death all the time. I deal with it in my job, and lately I've had to deal with it with the young woman. The reason that I'm against the Ouija board is because, and I'm not going to go into a long story about it, but many years ago, I decided, you know, oh, I'm going to use a Ouija board. And like everybody else, I was young and I was just getting into this. And I thought, oh, this is fun, 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 fun. Well, it's not fun, fun, fun. It's dangerous, and you can attract negative spirits, negative energy. And trust me, you don't want to go there. Don't even think about it. If you've had some success with the Ouija board before, that's fine, but one day you may not. And then you'll be calling me or emailing me for a recipe, or John, who's into potions and magic, you'll be calling him saying, "John, how do I get rid of this negative energy that's in my house?" And one day, John and I will have a show on many years that we've worked together in 10 years and all the very famous homes, I can't mention names, but that we have what I call despirited. Where there has been negative energy, and these are, of course, celebrities, but I can't mention the names, but we can get into some interesting things that we've been into and that we've come across, and it's going to make an interesting show. So we do all of that stuff, too. John, there's one that I know that you wanted me, and I just found it, to mention. It says, "Dear Sherry, I love the show. I have several questions for you. I'm wondering if you ever feel sorry for the killers you encounter." And I will come back to this in a second. I'm just going to read the whole thing. This was a very good email. "Wondering if you ever feel sorry for the killers you encounter. I know you sometimes experience their feelings and emotions. Have you ever encountered one that you felt bad for or experienced some sadness for?" The answer is yes and no. Do I feel sorry for the killers? The answer is no. Do I have sad feelings for them? Yes, because I know how tortured that they are. But the biggest sadness that I feel for them is where they're going to go when they pass on. Their punishment in this life is not half of what they're going to encounter when they pass over. I don't know how many of you remember the Green River Killer. Well, the Green River Killer was around for about 20 years. Well, about 10 years ago, I think it was 1997, I had a vision, and John and I had only been together at that point maybe about a year. And I was telling him that I had this dream, this vision, and I said, I saw this man walking along a dirt path, and there was a river there. And I said, I saw the initials GR. And I said, "Do you think it could be for the Green River Killer?" And he said, "Yeah, probably is." And so I said, well, the initial G for green and R for river would make sense because that's how I see. When I saw this vision, I saw like watching television. And this is how I see at night. That's how I tune in to crime. I'm not like some psychics that I know on television that say they can do 300 or 400 cases at a time, or like some psychics that I won't mention names of that have never even done a case, that don't know what on earth they're talking about, but they, you know, can answer a question like within 2 seconds. Well, it doesn't happen like that. When you tune into crime, you need to sit there and focus. And you can only do one crime at a time, because otherwise your guides would be showing you 10 different men and you're going to sit there and go, okay, is this case A or is this case B? Is this case C or D? Can you remember, imagine having 300 of them at one time? I don't think so. Anyway, getting back to this question, I only feel sorry for the killers because I know that they are going to have torture when they are on the other side. Not to mention the karma that they have to deal with in future lifetimes. They have to make up to every single person that they've done damage to. And, you know, when I realized that my father died, when he died, and I realized, and I was told by a very famous medium, who we all love and know, that I was keeping my father what I call downstairs. When I realized that he said that it was my fault that my father was being kept downstairs, I responded, well, how can that be? He didn't kill anyone. The medium said to me, he doesn't have to have killed someone for him to be in hell. All he has to do is you hate him. Your hate for him is enough to keep him downstairs. So I said, well, how do I bring him upstairs? I mean, I wasn't crazy about him. Yeah, I didn't like him because of what he did, you know, in my lifetime. But I don't hate him that much. I mean, he was my father. And, you know, I don't want him to be downstairs. How can I bring him back up? And the medium said to me, Sherry, the first thing you have to do is forgive him. Not just say you forgive him, because I responded, okay, I forgive him. And he goes, no, you can't do that. What you have to do is you have to mean it. You have to really, really mean it, like you really, true do forgive them. Well, it's kind of hard to forgive someone who's beaten you all your life, you know, and put you through misery and your family through misery. But I thought about it, and I thought, you know what? It bothers me more that he's downstairs, and it's my hatred for him that's keeping him there. So therefore, I'm going to be the big person and bring him up and out of being down there. You know, I mean, I wouldn't want that for my worst enemy. So, you know, I raised him upstairs and I finally did forgive him. I didn't forget, but I did forgive. And that was the beginning of my healing. And that happened 25 years ago. That medium changed my life. And he made me realize that it's through love, not hate, that you evolve. It's through love, not hate, that you raise yourself higher. So you don't want to be in the same frame of mind. It doesn't mean you have to turn the other cheek and let somebody slap you. You do have to protect yourself after all. But I am saying that sometimes in rare cases, it's good to forgive in order for you to heal and move on. And I needed to heal and to move on because it was wrecking my life. So when I see this question about this, you know, do I feel sorry for these killers? Of course not. But I do feel sorry because they have no idea what they're going to encounter. And they deserve it. They do deserve it. However, if they knew what they were going to encounter, they would never do the things that they do. So, you know, I hope that answers the question that this person has emailed into me. And the other question she had is, do you think the serial murders are influenced by bad spirits? Yeah, I do. And I feel that they call on them themselves. And we're going to be talking later about two of the worst. in the area where I live in Los Angeles. And one is the Night Stalker, and one is Charles Manson. And these are just very short stories I'm going to tell you about my dealing with both of these cases. I was very young, but, and one of them, especially Charles Manson, I was, you know, in my early 20s, I believe, 19, 20, 21, somewhere around there. And, you know, this other question, last question, do you know what happens to a killer when they die? Yes, they go downstairs, and they deserve to stay there. So those are the questions to that. John, did you have anything that you needed or wanted to add before we move on?
Can I go just a one step further on that question?
Sure.
About the killer.
Sure.
Whether or not you feel sorry for them. I personally have seen you tune in, and I know what you go through when you tune into these, and I know that a lot of times you actually are there with this killer. How do you feel about the killer at that moment?
That's a good question. At that moment, hatred. Mm-hmm. At that moment, despise the person. Probably if I, because I'm needing and wanting to protect a lot of times, and most of the time they're children that become are the victims.
The worst.
So in that respect, especially being a woman, especially being a mother, and especially, you know, being as sensitive as I am, because psychics, they call them sensitives. So if you're a sensitive, of course you're sensitive. You're going to be more sensitive than the normal person. But, you know, as a human being, I feel sorry for them because what they become. But at that moment, of course, there's sheer hatred. And I would protect that child. And in protecting that child, if I had had a gun, I probably would have, you know, maybe gave him a little shot somewhere to try and stop them if that's what I had to do.
It seems that real then.
Yeah.
That's something else. And this, I guarantee, will be a real interesting portion of this show. Sherry's going to be talking to us about how she got her start, not only as a psychic CSI, but as a psychic slash medium. And it starts with a very, very famous case. And with that, Sherry, I'm just going to turn the mic over to you.
Okay, yeah. The reason that I wanted to tell the story of how I got into this and what was happening to me at a time of my life that everything was upside down. The Night Stalker was running around Los Angeles. I lived in the Valley at the time in Woodland Hills. And I was getting these nightmares and these visions where every night I would see the murders of what was going to happen to the victims ahead of time. And I wasn't understanding, because you have to remember at that time, I was having a hard enough problem trying to understand that I was psychic, let alone having an ability to work on crime. Never in my life did it ever even dawn on me that I would ever become a psychic, that I was ever meant to become a psychic, or that I was going to be working with crime. If somebody had told me at that time that this is what I was going to end up doing, I would have said, you're crazy. One of the things, just to give you a little background, at the time the Night Stalker was running around killing people in Los Angeles, I believe was in the 80s, I'm thinking back now, and my son was young. I was a single mom. I had lost my home. I had moved from New York again, from New York, back to LA, and my son was just, you know, maybe under six years old, and I was broke, and I lost my beauty salon in Woodland Hills, and I was in a very, you know, sad place in my life. I was, you know, I didn't know what I was going to be doing. I didn't know how I was going to make a living. I had no money. They had repossessed my car. I was just in a very bad place living with my sister at the time, and she was going through a divorce. So, you know, everything was upside down in my life to begin with. And on top of it, I had just started to go to a metaphysical center where I was learning and studying under a very famous metaphysician teacher at the time. That was very well known. And he took me under his wing. I became his little protege. And, you know, I was trying to find some kind of balance in my life personally, let alone having to go to bed every night and watch people being murdered and the horrific things that the night stalker was doing to his victims. Well, I had to see all that, and I had to, you know, I had to be a part of that. And I ended up crying. I ended up, you know, becoming very disoriented. I was frustrated because my life wasn't going well enough, let alone, you know, seeing this stuff every night, or at least almost every night. So one day, as I found a job in a salon, I was working in the salon, and I had had, again, one of these visions. And again, I lived in Woodland Hills at the time. I was working in a salon in Tarzana. And I said to the owner, who was the one who got me into metaphysics, because she recognized that I was a medium. I didn't even know I was, but she did. And she was kind of became like a mother figure to me and a mentor in her own way. And she took me under her wing. Well, as she was my confidant, I was talking to her about the visions I was having. And I told her that I saw that the Night Stalker was going to be in the in the Woodland Hills area at Gemco on Ventura Boulevard near DeSoto. And I said, I saw him in the vision about 2 in the afternoon going into Gemco, because Gemco at that time was on Ventura Boulevard in DeSoto. And I saw him going in, and I saw him trying to purchase a gun. And I knew that he was going to be using some of the victim's ID. And I was trying to tell somebody about it so that maybe they could catch him. So I was proceeding to tell the owner of the salon. Well, she encouraged me to call the police. And I said, well, what am I going to tell him? That I'm some nut that's having dreams that, you know, he's going to, oh, yes, you're right. He's going to be in Gemco at 2 o'clock in the afternoon on Ventura Boulevard, and he's going to be trying to buy a gun and da, da, da. And, you know, it sounded ludicrous. I mean, it sounded totally ridiculous. And I felt that I was going to be treated like a total jerk. And as you know, from my mentioning previously, one thing that I had a very hard time handling was to be humiliated. So, you know, or made a fool of. So this was not really settling with me real well. However, it was bad enough that I finally had to get it off my chest. And I didn't want to end up knowing information that could help preventing somebody else's murder and keeping it to myself. So out of guilt, not wanting to hold back information that I felt could help prevent someone else's death, I proceeded to call the police from the salon that afternoon, with my mentor standing there next to me. And them telling, and they're going, oh, well, who are you? Well, oh, just don't let me guess. I bet you're psychic. I says, no, I'm not a psychic. I wasn't doing psychic stuff at the time. Oh, you're just, oh, this was a dream you had. He's going to be at Gemco at 2 o'clock this afternoon. Well, I'll make sure that we're there to greet him. And I was felt like a complete, total idiot. So I hung up the phone and I swore never again would I ever, ever go out on a limb like that again. And it taught me a very valuable lesson. When you get information, what do you do with it? What do you do if you see an airplane crash? What do you do if you see a volcanic eruption? What do you do if you see an earthquake? What do you do if you see a 9/11? What are you going to do? Call up the FBI or call up the CIA and say, guess what? I had a dream last night that the Al-Qaeda was going to, you know, was going to do what they're going to do in New York City. I mean, you know, people think that you're crazy. So where do you go with something like that? And especially if you are somebody that is unknown. There was one psychic that was arrested in Los Angeles a few years ago. She was a nurse, and she had a dream. She was not a psychic. She was a mother, grandmother type. She had a dream of a murder, and she knew where the woman's body was buried. So she called up the police, and she took them there. And guess what? they went along with her, going, wow, you had the dream and tell us about it and take us to the place. And wow, you know, and they went along with her and they're playing good guys and they're just patting her on the back, leading her on, giving her, blowing up her ego. And all of a sudden, guess what? Click, she's in the clanker. Well, of course, she was eventually let go, you know, and she sued them and she won. She won the case. But still, that, you know, goes to show you that you can't always just sit there and go, oh, well, I saw this. You know, I saw that there's going to be an airplane crash. And let me call up American Airlines and tell them about it. Well, the next thing you might know is you might be having somebody knocking on your door with handcuffs waiting for you. So you have to be careful. Unfortunately, we live in a time where people are skeptical, and there are a lot of people out there that do make crank calls and ruin it for the good ones. So that's my story with the Night Stalker. That was the beginning of me realizing that I had an ability to tune into crime. Lots of things happen that are good from having this kind of gift, but there's also the downside. I said to a client today that came in, I said, you know, people think it's easy. I said, I make it look easy when I close my eyes and I sit in my office and do a reading and I tune in and I come up with names and I come up with, you know, all this information, health, etc. They think it's really easy because I said, you know, I've been doing this for 25 years. They don't realize that I'm seeing a kaleidoscope of colors and numbers and names and letters and trees and cars and people, some of them upside down, some of them upright, you know, four-leaf clovers. I mean, you name it, and you can imagine that if you were watching television and you had all this stuff coming at you, in 2 seconds, without knowing anybody but their name, the person sitting in front of me, never met them before in my life, I have to take a kaleidoscope of stuff I'm seeing, translate it in my head to make it make sense to apply to the woman's life so that when it comes out of my mouth, she relates to it or he relates to it in 2 seconds. Otherwise, I've lost that person. They're out the door. So next time you go to a psychic, don't be so snide or don't be so quick to condemn, because you have no idea what that person is trying to go through to give you messages from above. It's not an easy thing to do.
You know, Sherry, there's getting back to the Night Stalker. It's such a famous case. What fascinates me is you're brand new at this. And
At that time, right.
And what must you have been going through when these horrific visions came to you? How did you weren't able to control them, were you?
No, I wasn't able to control them. I was trying to find somebody who could take them away. But I knew if I went to your local psychiatrist, they'd put me in the deep down cellars of life.
Right. So when obviously, the vision stopped when Richard Ramirez was arrested. The story you told about Richard Ramirez when he went to the GEMCO.
Right.
What was your reaction, and was this general knowledge in the shop that you worked in that you were having these visions, or was it just with the owner?
Yes. In fact, there was a guy from Italy.
I would really like to hear more about that.
Yeah, there was a guy from Italy that was trying to get me canned. Because of a superstition. I know you're Sicilian, but I married a Sicilian and I worked with one, and he was afraid of it. He had a fear of it. So he was trying, you know, yeah, it was a known thing that I was having these visions at the time. When the Night Stalker was finally seen in GEMCO, and you're right, John, I'm glad you brought that up because you're right. I totally forgot to mention what the outcome was. And that's the best part of the story. A few days later, or the next day, can't remember. You have to remember, this is like 20-some years ago.
It was a while back.
Yeah. It was in the newspaper. I picked up the newspaper, the Daily News, and there it was. That he was in GEMCO, and that he was trying to buy a gun in those days, in GEMCO, you could buy firearms and bullets. So he was in GEMCO, and he was trying to purchase a gun. The young girl behind the counter felt something was weird. She went by her instinct, and she felt something was weird. When he presented the victim's credit card, she said to the Night Stalker, Richard Ramirez, "Would you wait here 1 second while I check, you know, the card?" And she said, "I'll be right back," because after all, he was buying a gun. And when she came back, he was gone. She called the police. The police came, and she still had the ID from the victim that the Night Stalker had given her. And then they realized that it was the Night Stalker that they had missed. They also missed paying attention to what I was trying to tell them, the vision that I had had, because yes, he was in GEMCO around 2 o'clock, if not at 2 o'clock, that afternoon, and he was trying to purchase a gun, and he had the credit card information. So I was correct. I was 100% correct. At the time that it happened, I was angry. I was angry because I felt I was made to feel like an idiot. It discouraged me from ever again, for many, many years, wanting to call up and deal with the police. The police that at that time did still not understand anything about a person's vision or dreams, and they did not take it seriously. And even years later, when I started working with police departments, because people have to understand, not every police department or every police detective believes in psychics. So you may have in Los Angeles, for instance, several precincts that you may have five, and out of five, four of them don't believe in you and they don't want to work with you, but you have one that will, because one man may have had a personal experience, or they just happen to be spiritual, or they just happen to believe that psychics can be real. And so they'll work with you. But when he retires, that same precinct, unless you have a built up reputation, the next guy might not believe in it. So guess what? All your contacts have gone away. You know, Core TV, as John, you know, has been trying to get me to do something with them for a couple of years now. And I would love to be on Core TV. That was one of my goals. And they've contacted me several times. But one of the requirements is that you must have two police detectives that will come forward, that will go on television and right. back your story.
Right.
And I have one, but I don't have the other. The other is one in British Columbia where I found a guy underwater in 3 days. And the guy, the detective in British Columbia, is retired. He is able to go on television, but he refuses. He will not. He has told Court TV, yes, Sherry Mancuso did find this person. Yes, if it wasn't for her, we would never have found him, because he was under a lake in water. I mean, he just disappeared. They didn't know where he was. He could have been in the mountains or in the ground. They had no idea. And they found him in 3 days from his disappearance. So, but they would not go on television. So there, you know, that's the biggest problem that a psychic faces. And see, people don't realize this. They don't understand how difficult. So not only do you not get paid for these cases when you work with the police, but you can spend 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 months, or 2 years on a case. And John, you know, from when we've gone out.
Oh, yes.
You know, we have spent months. We've traveled to Moline, Illinois. We've traveled to New York. I myself, before I even met John, had gone up in the mountains in the Angeles Crest Highway in the middle of July when it's sweating to death. And there's rattlesnakes up there and bears and mountain lions. And trust me, it's a little spooky. You know, and I'm up there traipsing around in my little sneakers and my little T-shirt trying to find a missing person that I know is dead and is buried up there. You know, we would go up there for 9 or 10 hours. And I was there with my sister, my son, and 12 detectives drinking beer. I don't know if I should say that or not, but, you know.
Sherry, I've got another quick question.
Yeah.
you don't get paid.
Right. Why do you do it?
You don't get any recognition. Exactly.
I have a premonition. You're going to ask me the question of why do I do it?
Why do you do it?
You know why I do it, John? That's a good question. I do it because I know I can. I have the ability. I have the personality. You know, it is a rush. It's dangerous. Yes, very dangerous. I've had to move many, many times because I've been stalked. But, you know, in the end, I know that when I find a missing child or I give a family closure in any way, shape, or form I can, you know, that you can't buy that feeling.
No.
You can't put a price on that feeling.
No.
There's no amount of money in the world.
I agree.
That could give me enough satisfaction than I get from knowing I have helped somebody in that way. And I feel special, actually, and I feel very privileged to have that ability. It's just that I chew out my guides all the time. I think sometimes my clients are shocked because of the way sometimes they know that I talk to my guides, because I talk to them like I would talk to you.
Right.
You know, I say, hey, you guys, this is not working. This is not working. You cannot send me a guide like Einstein. Right. Who sends me equations and hieroglyphics and astrology, astrological symbols. I don't want to be an astrologer. I don't want to learn hieroglyphics, and I hate math. So send me somebody who's like me, who's simple, who can see butterflies and, you know, little cats and dogs and trees and bees and things that are normal and in everyday life, because I'm a very normal, basic, you know, simple person. You know, I'm not into all this other stuff, you know, so I don't want to study hieroglyphics and I don't want to study equations. So it doesn't, and they did. I told them, I said, if you want me to do this business, you're going to have to work with me. You're going to have to send me somebody that understands me and can relate to me as well as I can understand them and relate to them. So we're going to have to team up here. And we're going to have some balance. We're going to have to work together. And I'm sorry, but that's just how I had to say it, because that's how I felt. It was frustrating. You know, can you imagine how frustrating you're sitting there trying to read somebody and you're seeing hieroglyphics and, you know, astrological symbols? I mean, it's like reading, you know, Aztec or Mayan. You know, I mean, come on. It's a language. And I was totally, you know, frustrated because I didn't know what to do with what I was seeing.
I think it would be good, too, if on one of the shows we really delve deeper into symbology, et cetera, because that's what being psychic is really all about.
And dreams,
dream interpretations, Sherry. But you don't get any better than Sherry and John with dream interpretations.
We've done is the many, truth. We are
many,
the best.
We are. We're patting our
if
own
backs.
If
we ever
here.
Give a seminar in the future, you got to make sure you're theirs.
Exactly.
We are the best.
You know, Sherry, what else I find interesting is that even before the Night Stalker, your life was crisscrossed with crime. And especially here in Los Angeles.
Right. The Manson case. Well, the Manson case, what happened there is at 18, I started doing TV commercials. Again, I was not realizing I was psychic, never even thought about it, actually, never been to one. And I was living in Benedict Canyon. I had a little house up there on Yoakum Drive. And all of a sudden, you know, I started sleeping with a .22 caliber gun under my pillow with my trigger finger on the trigger. Yeah, that's to show you how much I know about guns. I don't even know what my finger was on.
I'm scared.
And I had this little .22 caliber gun that I bought, and I bought it because I was afraid. So I registered it with Santa Monica Police, did all the legal stuff I needed to do. And it was loaded, never fired a gun in my life. And I used to sleep with it every night with my finger on the trigger and put it under my pillow. And I just prayed I wouldn't move around too much, because otherwise I could end up shooting myself. The reason I slept with the gun was because when I took off my glasses at the time and my contacts, I couldn't see. I was legally blind at the age of 4. So if somebody came into my bedroom, I would be surprised and I wouldn't be able to see what was going on. So that's why. And the premonitions that I was having at the time was a fear. I felt that I was going to be murdered. And there were a lot of gory stuff I won't get into that I was having visions about and that, you know, later on showed up in the actual murders. I thought all that stuff was going to be done to me.
Now, for those of you folks who aren't familiar with the Manson murders, real briefly, it was a cult that was living out.
1969.
Right. It was a shack they were living in. And Charles Manson, who thought he was a prophet, was sending his disciples out
to murder,
if you remember the Helter Skelter connection from the Beatles, et cetera.
I think they lived in Tahunga, didn't they? Or Sun Valley?
I think it was Sun Valley.
Sun Valley, right.
And what Tate murders was Sharon Tate, very gruesome. She was pregnant at the time. And I think
9 months.
9 months. Coffee heiress.
Abigail Folger
was there. And then
Jay Sebring.
Right. That's right. Sebring.
Very famous hairdresser. And you know what ended up was weird?
What's that?
John, it ended up that the boyfriend I had at the time
and was living with
ended up going to hairdressing school with Jay Sebring.
He's a good friend of Jay's.
Yes. That's and you know what else happened? I understand now that the reason that I was picking up on those murders was because as a medium, you also pick on the area. You become like a bloodhound.
Right.
And you pick up on the area. And what my guides were trying to tell me was that I was living in an area where there was going to be a mass murder.
Right. Right.
And then the reason that I moved to Silver Lake around the corner from the La Bianca's was intuitively, I didn't know it at the time.
Right.
But I knew there'd be another mass murder that would happen with the same killers.
I think what it's really saying is that this was a path that was really meant for you, that you were going to be drawn to crime.
Right.
And this was just a precursor.
Yeah.
The precursor.
Right.
Of the
they give you like a menu of what's coming up
right.
in your life.
But there are also many odd circumstances to do with your family, too, as far as other members of your family that
oh,
have
yeah.
had brushes.
You got to buy the book when it comes out.
It's unbelievable.
You got to buy the book. You won't believe the
it
book.
It is. It's unbelievable.
We'll let you know when I write it.
Right. And then
when John helps me to write it.
And the La Bianca murders were the second set of murders. And I think what was so horrific is they were painting messages on the walls in blood. There was some
helter-skelter.
Satanistic,
satanic. And the same thing with the Richard Ramirez thing, the Night Stalker, for those
yes.
that don't know about the Night Stalker. He was going around and murdering people, gouging out eyes and you know, doing all kinds of raping the victims. And, you know, I really don't want to get into the gory details, John, to be quite honest with you, because it just brings up a lot of bad memories. And to be quite honest with you, I just kind of want to, like, move on. People don't understand that I lived through this, watching it, seeing it, like, and living color. And it brings up bad memories. And
right.
it brings up things that you know, for me, it's an experience that I don't want to go back to. I don't want to relive it. Maybe that's why I've never written a book about it, about the experiences that I went through. But, you know, they can go up on the internet. They can do research on Richard Ramirez, the Night Stalker, if they need to. And they can also go up on Charles Manson. I can't believe anybody today hasn't heard about Charles Manson, but maybe there are some people out there that haven't. So he's still alive. He's still in jail. So is Richard Ramirez, and they'll never get out.
Thank God.
Yeah.
Now we have a very special email that we want to share with you. We really want to spend some time on it because it's really an important message here that I know is going to benefit a lot of people, right, Sherry?
Yes. This young girl really touched my heart, and the reason she touched my heart is because number one, I was where she was at one time. When I was her age. So as you can see, we all, no matter what our paths are in life, we all have our ups and our downs, and we all have our problems in life that we try to overcome. And this little girl was very honest with me. She opened up her heart, and I had to, in turn, open mine up to hers. I'm going to read you part of her email, and then I'm going to let you know what my response was to her. Carrie, this is for you, honey. Dear Sherry, my name is Carrie and I'm 17 years old. I have questions that I would like your help with. I know that I'm only 17, but I feel like I'm just stuck in my life. I've been and still am very depressed. I've tried to commit suicide a few times, and I still think about it often. I've been on almost every antidepressant pill that you can imagine, but nothing has helped me. I've been dealing with depression and anxiety for so long that I feel like suicide is my only way out to get rid of it. I've been in a relationship for almost a year and a half. I love my boyfriend and want to marry him someday. It's hard for me to trust him because of things he's done to me. I'm afraid that I'm not going to heal. I'm afraid he's going to cheat on me. He has an addiction. One is pornography. When he talks to me, or when he talks about me online, he tells people bad things about me. He emails his old love interest and tells her bad things about me as well. Things that have been hidden on his computer from time to time just go on and on and on. I'm so confused because when he's with me, he's great. But when I see things he does and says on the computer, on the internet, he's a totally different person. And I'm having problems finishing school because of my depression. So Shakiri goes on to ask me if I feel that she's going to finish school. And I have responded to her by telling her, basically, I don't have my email here. I wish I did, that I gave a response. But I don't have it with me, and I'm sorry that I don't, because it was really good. But what I am going to tell you, basically, is that I told her a short story about not myself when I was her age. That's another story. And maybe sometime I'll tell you. But I wanted her to know about a young woman that I was very close with, was very dear to my heart. And I told her how this girl had talked to me in person about wanting to commit suicide because she couldn't find her path in life and she didn't know where to go. She was in her 20s. She had been all over the world. She had lost her country. She had come to the United States illegally. She was on her own. She was alone. She was unhappy. And she found happiness through different methods of different kinds of work. And some of them were legitimate and some of them were not. And she got on the wrong path of life. And she met a very nice young man. And he was very good to her, and they started a business together. To make a long story short, they had 5 years together. Then they broke up. And they broke up because she became depressed and started taking pills. When she started taking the antidepressant pills, she got worse. And she would take more and more and more and more. Because one didn't do it anymore. Two didn't do it anymore. Three didn't do it. So she'd go to four and so on and so on. When this young man and she broke up, it broke all the parents' hearts because they were really looking forward to this marriage of this young couple. The consequences were they broke up. She found somebody else. She found a man who had some problems, who was very prominent, older than her, more of a father figure, a cocaine addict, and drinking and living the high life. She followed. She got caught up in the rat race of drugs. And the antidepressant pills mixed with the alcohol, mixed with the drugs, gave her an attempt on her life once that they rushed her to the hospital. She spent 10 days in the hospital and they pumped her stomach and she survived. The second time she survived. The third time she did not. When she died, because I was close to her, and you have to remember, this was someone that was very close to me, extremely close, almost like family. And when she died, I was wondering if she was going to come to me. Well, she did. One night, as I lay in bed shortly after she died, right before I went to her funeral, she came to me, and she was crying hysterically. And she was all in black. The whole... The vision of what I saw was like looking at a black television with her in the middle. There were no lights. There were no people. There were no trees. There was no grass. There was no homes. There was no family. There was nothing. There was no place for her to sit. There was nothing. All she could do is stand in the middle of this black hole. And she cried out to me, telling me how sorry she was, telling me she didn't mean it, asking me, "Sherry, please help me. Please bring me back." And I told her, "I can't. It's too late. I can't bring you back." In the midst of all my tears, and there were plenty of them, I cried for 2 hours. As tears poured down my face as I lay in bed, watching the scene and the vision of this young girl that I loved so dearly, crying out to me for help, and I couldn't help her. All I could do was tell her, "I can't bring you back. I wish I could, but I can't." And she said she was stuck in the hole, the black hole. And I told her that I had warned her that when you take your own life, unfortunately, you're in limbo. And that you're going to be surrounded by black. And this is what I told her one time as we sat and talked by ourselves. And she was being totally honest with me, as this young girl who emailed me, named Carrie, was so honest with me. So my young friend continued to stand there in the black. And she had nowhere to go. And she knew that she was going to be there for eternity. I knew that she could be stuck there for eternity. And it was worse than any hell anyone ever could have imagined. Mentally, emotionally, and physically and spiritually, she was stuck in a black hole. So I told her in desperation to hold out her hand. I didn't even know if she could hold out her hand. I didn't even know what I was saying. I didn't even know what I was doing. I was desperate to help her some way, somehow. So I told her to hold out her hand. She did. And all of a sudden, like through a black curtain, I saw a hand that looked like a normal hand poke out. I reached up in my bed, even though I knew I really probably couldn't touch her. And I told her to grab my hand. I would hold up my hand. Apparently, it worked because she grabbed it. I pulled her through. Once I pulled her through, for the next hour and a half, she showed me visions of her father and her mother crying desperately over her death. She was so sad and sorry. She didn't realize how much she had and would hurt her parents. She didn't realize how much she would hurt her brother. She didn't realize how much she hurt the people that loved her, that she left behind, because they were in their own black hole, because they didn't know why. They couldn't understand why a young girl would want to die so desperately when they had tried so desperately to give her love. This was a young woman who came from a very, very upscale, well-to-do family. This is not someone who came from a broken and battered home. Her parents were married. They went to church. They believed in God. They did everything right for their young daughter. In fact, she was brought up in another country with maids and butlers and chauffeurs and cooks. So she by no means was in desperation for anything else. They gave her love. She loved her father, liked her mother, not crazy about her, but she loved her father. The last thing she ever would have done was to hurt her father in this way, but she did. And when she died, she realized what she had done, but it was too late. And the one person she came to was me, because she knew and trusted that not only would I see her, but I would in some way maybe be able to help her. I was able to help her. I led her through to the white light. And out of her desperation and her sadness and her tears of remorse, I guess whoever's upstairs felt her pleas for help and saw her anguish and saw her feeling sorry for what she did, her remorse. So therefore, they decided that they were not going to penalize her for all of eternity. They were going to allow her to come through that curtain of black. of which she held out her hand, and I was able to pull her through. And I was able to pull her up and under the white light. And I led her to the white light. And I walked her through to the white light so that she could go on to the people that some she knew in this lifetime and some she didn't, her family. She went into her own special world waiting for her. And I know that she's happy. I do see her, and I know some of you are going to email me and ask me if I have seen her since. Yes, I have. And it's still very sad. In fact, when I was telling the story, sitting at the radio station, all of a sudden, I felt her coming through in my body, and I knew she was here.
With the email from Carrie, did you respond? You responded to her by email?
Yes, and you know what? After I told that sad story, I did find her email that she emailed to me after.
What I really would like to know maybe a little bit more about the advice that you gave her and what her reaction was.
Well, I have her reaction. I just saw it here. I have to, here it is.
Oh, good.
Sherry, I'm sorry to hear about the young woman who was so close to you. Thank you for responding to my email. Thank you for telling me what would happen if I were to commit suicide. The reasons I haven't committed suicide were because I didn't know what would happen to me after I died. I didn't want to hurt my family, and I just hoped that things would get better if I lived. I've tried so many things to get better, and I don't know what else to do. It feels like I'm being punished, and that's why my life isn't working out. What can I do to get better? Am I ever going to get out of my depression? You said I should get out of my relationship because things would get worse. What's going to happen? Without him, I just wouldn't have anyone else. I don't have any close friends. I have so much to say, but it's hard to type it all in an email. And Carrie, my answer to you on that is the relationship, if this is a young man who doesn't cherish you enough to put you up on a pedestal, instead, he tries to humiliate you and belittle you and tear you down mentally, emotionally. Next time, it'll be physically. I was raised in a family with abuse. I was raised in a family that had a problem with alcohol. So I know what mental and emotional and physical torture, and I mean torture, can be, because I lived it. And the one thing that I would never, ever, ever give any person any power, whether it's a man, whether it's a woman, or whether it's anyone who tried to humiliate me, tear me down, belittle me, or make me feel like I was dumb or stupid or I was less than what I could or should be, that person would be out of my life so fast it would make their heads spin. I have more feeling for myself than that. I care about myself. I like myself and I love myself. And I want you to like yourself and love yourself too. And let me ask you this, Carrie. If you don't love yourself, how can anyone else? You have to love yourself first before someone else can love you. And because I know that you don't want to be on this planet, that tells me right there you don't love yourself. So you do need to get some kind of help, because committing suicide, trust me, is not the answer. That is not the way to go. And as far as close friends, there are places that you can go to get help, to meet people your own age and, you know, around your age that care about you. You know, I don't even know you, and I felt like wrapping my arms around you and helping you. So, you know, if I, as a stranger, can feel that way, there's tons of people out there that would love to be your friend. And I encourage listeners to respond to Carrie, to email in, and just when you go up on the Psychic CSI show, just click where you leave me an email and respond. And maybe you have some advice. Maybe you want to reach out. Maybe you know someone who's got the problem. Maybe you know someone who's able to give her advice that I didn't think of, you know. So this is what this show is about, too. This is not just about, you know, John and I sitting here. This is about you. This is about what we can do to help you. That's what this gift is for. this gift is for guidance, not just about to tell you that, you know, you're going to meet, Harry's going to meet Sally, you know, and you're going to live happily ever after in a big mansion somewhere. This is about life, and this is about health, and this is about, you know, death and how to heal and how to move on to your right path in life. That's what mediumship is about, not control. And Carrie, nobody should control you. Nobody in your life should ever have enough control over you to where you feel like you are nothing, to where you don't want to live. Shame on him. And if he's treating you like this, God forbid you marry him. How do you think he's going to talk and treat your children? And if you want this to go on into a cycle, what good are you doing your future children and grandchildren? You're not. So you deserve better. And I would look at twice at him about being a father, let alone a husband. Okay, John, I just got off on that tangent there. But there's,
Sherry, I agree with you 100%. I think the hidden benefits that a lot of people don't realize with psychics or mediums, etc., is that we are very empathetic. And we feel the emotion that person sitting in front of us or sitting at the end of the telephone line or at the end of from keyboard to keyboard. We feel that. And that's what Sherry is, I think, most adept at. She connects on such a personal level. And that she just hones in. It's just amazing. But like I was saying, I think the real hidden benefit here is, when a lot of people ask me or ask you, well, what good is it if you see all these things? Well, I'll tell you what the good is, and we've said it a million times, we teach classes, and this is a kind of a catchphrase, but when you get a psychic reading or you get somebody tunes in for you, you maximize the positive and you can minimize the negative. Not everything's preventable.
Right.
But if you can minimize the negative impact, that whatever this vision that was seen for you, and maximize whatever good that can come out of it, you're ahead, aren't you, Sherry?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Okay, and I think on that note, Sherry, I think we're pretty much running out of time. I want to encourage everyone to send in emails.
Yeah, and especially for Carrie. Mm-hmm. I think it's really important that you guys out there really let her know that we care about her. She doesn't feel that she has anyone that cares. And maybe, you know, there might be some handsome young guy out there that might be interested, maybe emailing Carrie. Maybe we can get a love connection here. By the way, I'm very good at tuning in on whose love is good for who. You know, so there's lots of things we're going to be doing on up and coming shows. So make sure you continue to tune in and keep those emails coming. We love them.
Great. We want to thank you for tuning in and listening to us on Psychic CSI at planetparanormal.com. See you next time.
See you next time.